they inquiringly. Receiver of stolen goods, perhaps? What he did say was, a businessman. That's rather a general description, Lieutenant Keith. Keith looked at him sharply and then said with something rather like ill temper, he's a thingam, my Bob, a house agent, say. I'm going to see him. Oh, you're going to see a house agent, are you? Said Rupert Grant grimly. Do you know, Mr. Keith, I think I should very much like to go with you. Basil shook with his soundless laughter. Lieutenant Keith started a little, his brow blackened sharply. I beg your pardon, he said. What did you say? Rupert's face had been growing from stage to stage of ferocious irony, and he answered, I was saying that I wondered whether you would mind our strolling along with you to this house agent's. The visitor swung his stick with a sudden whirling violence. Oh, in God's name, come to my house agent's. Come to my bedroom, look under my bed, examine my dustbin, come along. And with a furious energy which took away our breath, he banged his way out of the room. Rupert Grant, his restless blue eyes dancing with his detective excitement, soon shouldered alongside him, talking to him with that transparent camaraderie which he imagined to be appropriate from the disguised policeman to the disguised criminal. His interpretation was certainly corroborated by one particular detail, the unmistakable unrest, annoyance, and nervousness of the man with whom he walked. Basil and I tramped behind, and it was not necessary for us to tell each other that we had both noticed this. Lieutenant Drummond Keith led us through very extraordinary and unpromising neighborhoods in the search for his remarkable houseguest. Neither of the brothers Grant failed to notice this fact. As the streets grew closer and more crooked, and the roofs lower, and the gutters grosser with mud, a darker curiosity deepened on the brows of Basil, and the figure of Rupert, seen from behind, seemed to fill the street with a gigantic swagger of success. At length, at the end of the fourth or fifth lean gray street in that sterile district, we came suddenly to a halt. The mysterious lieutenant looked once more about him with a sort of sulky desperation. Above a row of shutters and a door, all indescribably dingy in appearance and in size, scarce sufficient even for a penny toy shop, ran the inscription, P. Montmorency, House Agent. This is the office of which I spoke, said Keith in a cutting voice. Will you wait here a moment, or does your astonishing tenderness about my welfare lead you to wish to overhear everything I have to say to my business advisor? Rupert's face was white and shaking with excitement. Nothing on earth would have induced him now to have abandoned his prey. If you will excuse me, he said, wrenching his hands behind his back, I think I should feel myself justified in... Oh, come along in, exploded the lieutenant. He made the same gesture of savage surrender, and he slammed into the office, the rest of us at his heels. P. Montmorency, house agent, was a solitary old gentleman sitting behind a bare brown counter. He had an egg-like head, frog-like jaws, and a gray, hairy fringe of aureole around the lower part of his face, the whole combined with a reddish, aquiline nose. He wore a shabby black frock coat, a sort of semi-clerical tie, worn at a very unclerical angle, and looked, generally speaking, about as unlike a house agent as anything could look, short of something like a sandwich man or a Scotch Highlander. We stood inside the room for fully 40 seconds, and the odd old gentleman did not look at us. Neither, to tell the truth, odd as he was, did we look at him. Our eyes were fixed, where his were fixed, upon something that was crawling about on the counter in front of him. It was a ferret. The silence was broken by Rupert Grant. He spoke in that sweet and steely voice which he reserved for great occasions and practiced for hours together in his bedroom. He said, Mr. Montmorency, I think. The old gentleman started, lifted his eyes with a bland bewilderment, picked up the ferret by the neck, stuffed it alive into his trousers pocket, smiled apologetically, and said, Sir, you are a house agent, are you not? Asked Rupert. To the delight of that criminal investigator, Mr. Montmorency's eyes wandered unquietly towards Lieutenant Keith, the only man present that he knew. A house agent, cried Rupert again, bringing out the word as if it were burglar. "Yes, oh yes," said the man with a quavering and almost coquettish smile. "I am a house agent. Oh yes." "Well, I think," said Rupert with a sardonic sleekness, "that Lieutenant Keith wants to speak to you. We have come in by his request." Lieutenant Keith was lowering gloomily, and now he spoke. "I have come, Mr. Montmorency, about that house of mine." "Yes, sir," said Montmorency, spreading his fingers on the flat counter. "It's all ready, sir. I have attended to all your suggestions." "About the right," said Keith, cutting the word short with the startling neatness of a gunshot. "We needn't bother about all that. If you've done what I told you, all right." And he turned sharply toward the door. Mr. Montmorency, house agent, presented a picture of pathos. After stammering a moment, he said, "Excuse me, Mr. Keith, there was another matter, about which I wasn't quite sure. I tried to get all the heating apparatus possible under the circumstances, but in winter, at that elevation..." "Can't expect much, hey?" said the lieutenant, cutting in with the same sudden skill. "No, of course not. That's all right, Montmorency. There can't be any more difficulties," and he put his hand on the handle of the door. "I think," said Rupert Grant with a satanic suavity, "that Mr. Montmorency has something further to say to you, Lieutenant." "Only," said the house agent in desperation, "what about the birds?" "I beg your pardon," said Rupert in a general blank. "What about the birds?" said the house agent doggedly. Basil, who had remained throughout the proceedings in a state of Napoleonic calm, which might be more accurately described as a state of Napoleonic stupidity, suddenly lifted his leonine head. "Before you go, Lieutenant Keith," he said, "come now, really, what about the birds?" "I'll take care of them," said Lieutenant Keith, still with his long back turned to us. "They shan't suffer." "Thank you, sir, thank you," cried the incomprehensible house agent with an air of ecstasy. "You'll excuse my concern, sir. You know I'm wild on wild animals. I'm as wild as any of them on that. Thank you, sir. But there's another thing." The lieutenant, with his back turned to us, exploded with an indescribable laugh and swung round to face us. It was a laugh, the purport of which was direct and essential, and yet which one cannot exactly express. As near as it said anything, verbally speaking, it said, "Well, if you must spoil it, you must, but you don't know what you're spoiling." "There is another thing," continued Mr. Montmorency weakly. "Of course, if you don't want to be visited, you'll paint the house green. But..." "Green," shouted Keith. "Green. Let it be green or nothing. I won't have a house of another color. Green," and before he could realize anything, the door had banged between us and the street. Rupert Grant seemed to take a little time to collect himself, but he spoke before the echoes of the door died away. "Your client, Lieutenant Keith, appears somewhat excited," he said. "What is the matter with him? Is he unwell?" "Oh, I should think not," said Mr. Montmorency in some confusion. "The negotiations have been somewhat difficult. The house is rather..." "Green," said Rupert calmly. "That appears to be a very important point. It must be rather green. May I ask you, Mr. Montmorency, before I rejoin my companion outside, whether in your business it is usual to ask for houses by their color? Do clients write to a house agent asking for a pink house or a blue house, or, to take another instance, for a green house?" "Only," said Montmorency, trembling, "only to be inconspicuous." Rupert had his ruthless smile. "Can you tell me any place on earth in which a green house would be inconspicuous?" The house agent was fidgeting nervously in his pocket. Slowly drawing out a couple of lizards and leaving them to run on the counter, he said, "No, I can't." "You can't suggest an explanation?" "No," said Mr. Montmorency, rising slowly and yet in such a way as to suggest a sudden situation. "I can't. And may I, as a busy man, be excused if I ask you, gentlemen, if you have any demand to make of me in connection with my business, what kind of house would you desire me to get for you, sir?" He opened his blank blue eyes on Rupert, who seemed for the second staggered. Then he recovered himself with perfect common sense and answered, "I am sorry, Mr. Montmorency. The fascination of your remarks has unduly delayed us from joining our friend outside. Pray excuse my apparent impertinence." "Not at all, sir," said the house agent, taking a South American spider idly from his waistcoat pocket and letting it climb up the slope of his desk. "Not at all, sir. I hope you will favor me again." Rupert Grant dashed out of the office in a gust of anger, anxious to face Lieutenant Keith. He was gone. The dull, starlit street was deserted. "What do you say now?" cried Rupert to his brother. His brother said nothing now. We all three strode down the street in silence, Rupert feverish, myself dazed, Basil to all appearance merely dull. We walked through gray street after gray street, turning corners, traversing squares, scarcely meeting anyone except occasional drunken knots of two or three. In one small street, however, the knots of two or three began abruptly to thicken into knots of five or six, and then into great groups, and then into a crowd. The crowd was stirring very slightly, but anyone with a knowledge of the eternal populace knows that if the outside rim of a crowd stirs ever so slightly, it means that there is madness in the heart and core of the mob. It soon became evident that something really important had happened in the center of this excitement. We wormed our way to the front with the cunning which is known only to Cockneys, and once there we soon learned the nature of the difficulty. There had been a brawl concerned with some six men, and one of them lay almost dead on the stones of the street. Of the other four, all interesting matters were, as far as we were concerned, swallowed up in one stupendous fact. One of the four survivors of the brutal and perhaps fatal scuffle was the immaculate Lieutenant Keith, his clothes torn to ribbons, his eyes blazing, blood on his knuckles. One other thing, however, pointed at him in a worse manner. A short sword or a very long knife had been drawn out of his elegant walking stick and lay in front of him upon the stones. It did not, however, appear to be bloody. The police had already pushed into the center with their ponderous omnipotence, and even as they did so, Rupert Grant sprang forward with his incontrollable and intolerable secret. "That is the man, Constable," he shouted, pointing at the battered lieutenant. "He is a suspicious character. He did the murder." "There's been no murder done, sir," said the policeman with his automatic civility. "The poor man's only hurt. I shall only be able to take the names and addresses of the men in the scuffle and have a good eye kept on them." "Have a good eye kept on that one," said Rupert, pale to the lips and pointing to the ragged Keith. "All right, sir," said the policeman unemotionally, and went the round of the people present collecting the addresses. When he had completed his task, the dusk had fallen, and most of the people not immediately connected with the examination had gone away. He still found, however, one eager-faced stranger lingering on the outskirts of the affair. It was Rupert Grant. "Constable," he said, "I have a very particular reason for asking you a question. Would you mind telling me whether that military fellow who dropped his sword stick in the row gave you an address or not?" "Yes, sir," said the policeman after a reflective pause. "Yes, he gave me his address." "My name is Rupert Grant," said that individual with some pomp. "I have assisted the police on more than one occasion. I wonder whether you would tell me as a special favor what address." The constable looked at him. "Yes," he said slowly, "if you like. His address is The Elms, Buxton Common, near Purley, Surrey." "Thank you," said Rupert, and ran home through the gathering night as fast as his legs could carry him, repeating the address to himself. Rupert Grant generally came down late in a rather lordly way to breakfast. He contrived, I don't know how, to achieve always the attitude of the indulged younger brother. Next morning, however, when Basil and I came down, we found him ready and restless. "Well," he said sharply to his brother almost before we sat down to the meal, "what do you think of your Drummond Keith now?" "What do I think of him?" inquired Basil slowly. "I don't think anything of him." "I'm glad to hear it," said Rupert, buttering his toast with an energy that was somewhat exultant. "I thought you'd come round to my view, but I own I was startled at your not seeing it from the beginning. The man is a translucent liar and knave." "I think," said Basil, in the same heavy monotone as before, "that I did not make myself clear. When I said that I thought nothing of him, I meant grammatically what I said. I meant that I did not think about him, that he did not occupy my mind. You, however, seem to me to think a lot of him, since you think him a knave. I should say he was glaringly good myself." "I sometimes think you talk paradox for its own sake," said Rupert, breaking an egg with unnecessary sharpness. What the deuce is the sense of it? Here is a man whose original position was, by our common agreement, dubious. He's a wanderer, a teller of tall tales, a man who doesn't conceal his acquaintance with all the blackest and bloodiest scenes on earth. We take the trouble to follow him to one of his appointments, and if ever two human beings were plotting together and lying to everyone else, he and that impossible house agent were doing it. We followed him home, and the very same night he is in the thick of a fatal or near-fatal brawl in which he is the only man armed. Really, if this is being glaringly good, I must confess that the glare does not dazzle me. Basil was quite unmoved. I admit his moral goodness is a certain kind, a quaint, perhaps a casual kind. He is very fond of change and experiment, but all the points you so ingeniously make against him are mere coincidence or a special pleading. It's true he didn't want to talk about his house business in front of us. No man would. It's true that he carries a sword stick. Any man might. It's true he drew it in the shock of a street fight. Any man would. But there's nothing really dubious in all this. There's nothing to confirm. As he spoke, a knock came at the door. If you please, sir, said the landlady with an alarmed air, there's a policeman wants to see you. Show him in, said Basil, amid the blank silence. The heavy, handsome constable who appeared at the door spoke almost as soon as he appeared there. I think one of you gentlemen, he said, curtly but respectfully, was present at the affair in Copper Street last night and drew my attention very strongly to a particular man. Rupert half rose from his chair with eyes like diamonds, but the constable went on calmly, referring to a paper. A young man with gray hair, had light gray clothes, very good, but torn in the struggle, gave his name as Drummond Keith. This is amusing, said Basil, laughing. I was in the very act of clearing that poor officer's character of rather fanciful aspersions. What about him? Well, sir, said the constable, I took all the men's addresses and had them all watched. It wasn't serious enough to do more than that. All the other addresses are all right, but this man Keith gave a false address. The place doesn't exist. The breakfast table was nearly flung over as Rupert sprang up, slapping both his thighs. Well, by all that's good, he cried, this is a sign from heaven. It's certainly very extraordinary, said Basil quietly with knitted brows. It's odd the fellow should have given a false address, considering he was perfectly innocent in the... Oh, you jolly old early Christian duffers, cried Rupert in a sort of rapture. I don't wonder you couldn't be a judge. You think everyone as good as yourself. Isn't the thing plain enough now? A doubtful acquaintance, rowdy stories, a most suspicious conversation, mean streets, a concealed knife, a man nearly killed, and finally a false address? That's what we call glaring goodness. It's certainly very extraordinary, repeated Basil, and he strolled moodily about the room. Then he said, You are quite sure, Constable, that there's no mistake. You got the address right, and the police have really gone to it and found it was a fraud? It was very simple, sir, said the policeman, chuckling. The place he named was a well-known common quite near London, and our people were down there this morning before any of you were awake. And there's no such house. In fact, there are hardly any houses at all. Though it is so near London, it's a blank moor with hardly five trees on it, to say nothing of Christians. Oh, no, sir, the address was a fraud, right enough. He was a clever rascal and chose one of those scraps of lost England that people know nothing about. Nobody could say offhand that there was not a particular house dropped somewhere about the heath, but as a fact, there isn't. Basil's face, during this sensible speech, had been growing darker and darker with a sort of desperate sagacity. He was cornered almost for the first time since I had known him, and to tell the truth, I rather wondered at the almost childish obstinacy which kept him so close to his original prejudice in favor of the wildly questionable lieutenant. At length he said, You really searched the common, and the address was really not known in the district. By the way, what was the address? The constable selected one of his slips of paper and consulted it, but before he could speak, Rupert Grant, who was leaning in the window in a perfect posture of the quiet and triumphant detective, struck in with the sharp and suave voice he loved so much to use. "Well, I can tell you that, Basil," he said graciously as he idly plucked leaves from a plant in the window. "I took the precaution to get this man's address.